Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, time for the Friday gathering, and this week I'm joined by Barry Cowan, Fianna Fáil MEP for Midlands North West, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal, and party spokesperson on social protection, rural and community development, Harry McGee, political correspondent with the Irish Times, and Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Now, the latest Exchequer returns this week show are on course for another record tax year, thanks to bumper corporation tax receipts, despite the economic uncertainty around US tariffs. So, Louise, the government, does it need to go back to the drawing board when it comes to managing people's expectations around budget 2026 in light of the extra billions coming in?
Well, I think they need to recognise that the cost of living crisis isn't over, and they do need to include in the package a cost of living in the budget, a cost of living package. I mean, my colleague MEP Lynn Boylan uncovered figures, or got figures from the department last week, that show that 300,000 households are in arrears now with their electricity bills, over 100,000 with their gas bill. We also have the situation whereby parents, Bernardo's are telling us, parents are getting into debt just to manage back to school costs. And the Ombudsman for Children was at an Oireachtas committee just before the Dáil went into recess, and he said that child poverty had doubled in the last year. So all of these are telling us that, all of the available evidence tells us that the cost of living crisis isn't over, and that the government, instead of setting their face repeatedly against a cost of living package, should actually not just listen to the opposition, and perhaps they should do that sometimes, but also listen to people representing those groups that are heading into the winter with their kids going back to school, getting themselves into debt and not able to manage. Their cost of living crisis very much is not over. And the tax receipts and the fact that we have surpluses all underline the fact that the government should acknowledge that there is a cost of living crisis for many families. It's very real, and they need an intervention in this budget.
And Barry Cowan, we were talking to Charlie Weston earlier about grocery bills and prices rising for people's shopping trolleys. So with the extra money coming into the Exchequer, it'll be a hard case to make to people that the government can't afford to help them.
To Charlie, before the programme, it's interesting to hear his comments and the recommendations emanating from his comments and the report that he was referring to. Look, it's good news. It can't be taken for granted. You know, considering, as you said, the geopolitical situation and the issue with US tariffs and so forth. But you know, there's also a sharp rise in exports, it needs to be noted. Corporation tax up 14%, and income tax and VAT is also up 4.5%. Compared to last year. So that tells us the economy is resilient. We have a record labour force. This doesn't happen by accident. You know, it's down to prudent management by the government, and that the economy is responding well to difficulties. But there are, as has been alluded to, there are issues in relation to the cost of living that will have to be addressed in the context of the budget, and the government will have choices to make. And I've no doubt that they'll be discussing and prioritising over the coming months with a view to making an indentation in those issues around cost of living. We can't necessarily go as far as we went in previous budgets, but there is an effort maybe to target specific areas, whether it be VAT, you know, retaining the VAT reduction in relation to ESB bills, whether it's looking at targeted measures to help those that are being impacted in relation to back to school, in relation to college fees and so forth.
But the likes of we can't do one budget.
Five budgets in one, you know.
Okay, but the likes of energy credits or double child benefit or those kind of things for which people will be...
No, the government has indicated that they won't be to the same extent as they were previously. But there is an effort on the part of ministers being charged with the responsibility of targeted measures, which can be, you know, much more targeted and impact on those that need it most at this crucial time.
All right, Harry, targeted is an area where the debate will come down to, and who gains and who loses when the target is fixed.
Yeah, and there are lots of signals coming from Merrion Street about what kind of budget is going to be framed. And I think that Pascal Donoghue and Jack Chambers must have been looking at recent episodes of Ireland's Fittest Family, because they're telling all their ministers to hang tough when they come looking for extra funds. So essentially, in the last 4 or 5 years, what we've had in addition to the budget have been these once-off payments to help people get over various crises, starting with COVID, going to cost of living and also the energy crisis. Both Pascal Donoghue and Jack Chambers are adamant that it's not going to happen this year. And of course, college fees was part of that kind of package of once-off cuts, the 1,000 reduction in college registration fees last year. And James Lawless made the mistake of essentially stating a current government policy earlier on this year and found himself being monstered by the opposition and indeed by some of his own coalition colleagues. So they're saying that there aren't going to be these universal once-off payments. And that's difficult because, as Louise was saying, you know, there is a lot of people who are facing arrears in relation to energy. There are college fees. We're in a very uncertain climate. But on the other side of the equation, there are people saying that we have full employment in the Irish economy. Gabriel MacLouf at the weekend was telling the Business Post that, you know, that he thinks that the budget as is, that 10.4 billion package, is already over-expansionary and it's in danger of overheating the Irish economy. And he's essentially counselling that maybe they should kind of pare back on that and make a lesser budget.
Come September, Louise, could you see the pressure being massive and this dominating the likes of leaders' questions, the issue when the back-to-school bills come in, return-to-college bills come in, and the heating goes on and the tumble dryers go on as we enter the wetter weather?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think if you look at the last few weeks of the last Dáil term, it was all cost of living. You had the college fee issue, like Harry said, but it was stuff like groceries, it was stuff like supermarket prices, and it was very much being put to the fore in the political calendar. And I mean, I suppose when you look at September, it is, yes, peak budget time. But don't forget as well, we will have an election in and around that time now, a presidential election. So perhaps there's less at stake for the government. And I think they were accused last year of doing this big giveaway budget in preparation for the general election. But they are still going to be going out knocking on doors. They are going to be coming face to face with people. And if you're looking at an election in October, November, that is, like you said, that peak time of the heating going back on, the evenings getting a little bit darker that bit earlier, lights having to go on, tumble dryers. So it's not only going to be in the Dáil that they're going to be facing this, it's also going to be when they're meeting punters, when they're going pounding the pavement. So it's a tough time. Now, they seem to be adamant that they're going to hold firm. We'll see what happens come September, but I do believe them a little bit more, I think, this time than I did in previous years.
All right. As Harry was saying, Louise, though, the central bank has raised concern about the proposed budget. The Fiscal Advisory Council has said, you know, the spending is not anchored in responsible policy anymore. So there are those voices talking about a sustainable, broad-based raising of income and not to undermine that with expenditure so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. So in that context, are the universal benefits that you're calling for, should they be set aside and more targeted measures looked at?
Well, I think if we go back to the start of this, right? So things that the government can do, choices that the government can make. The government could choose not to make it harder for parents who have kids in college. So, you know, they could not put up the cost of going to college, which is effectively what they have done. It was $2,000 last year. It will be $3,000 this year. And parents and students have already received those bills. So I think if the government were to start perhaps from the position of maybe just not making it worse or harder for families.
You could expand the thresholds on the SUSE grants, for example, and capture people who are finding it most difficult to send their children to college instead of a universal benefit, which ends up being a subsidy for people to send their children to fee-paying schools, which is what happened when free education was introduced in the first place.
The reason being, you often hear talk about this, you know, that we need a Donna O'Malley moment. And, you know, the Donna O'Malley moment was about the universal application of access to education. Because do you know what? It is a good thing if people can afford to get educated. There wasn't a tiered system. There was access to education. So access to education is incredibly important and it needs to be made accessible and affordable. So therefore, when you put up the cost of education, all that it does is it impedes people being able to access access college. So when we talk about education as a universal good, that doesn't stop at the age of 18. It is good that people will be able to afford to go to college. It is not good that the government
choices have to be made,
€1,000 onto families that are already pressed, particularly in the context of the fact that 300,000 people are heading into the winter. It's not even cold yet and they are already in arrears on their energy bills. So those people need help from the government. They are, you know, and hopefully the government will meet them on the doorsteps and they will hear directly from them. But I hear from them and I can tell you that people are already struggling. Okay. They need that cost of living package.
Barry Cowan, people will want to know what targeted means and who's going to lose out in any targeted measures.
I think, first of all, in relation to the Donna O'Malley moment, I think that may be more akin in today's society for preschool and play school and the improvements that have been made there and the commitments that are made within the programme for government to continue along that vein. But there is also in the programme for government a commitment to address the issue of college fees. And we will see in the budget, I'm sure, an indication from government as to the depth of that package over a period of governance as to how that will be addressed. And there will be targeted measures. You know, Sinn Féin can call for universal supports, but, you know, if Sinn Féin or where Sinn Féin and government, there's no doubt that there'd be increase in taxes, income tax, to address all these deficiencies that they recognise. But the problem with that is that, you know, you hit tax of that nature, it's a tax on jobs. A tax on jobs is an impact on revenue resources. The impact of revenue resource reduction is the inability to address many of these deficiencies in relation to public services.
All right, Louisa Ray, do you want to answer that before we move on to another?
Yes, because we have consistently called for a mix of both targeted and universal measures. We publish our alternative budget every single year, and indeed we believe that those who can shoulder the burden most should pay the most, and I would make absolutely no apologies for that. But, you know, I mean, Barry talks a lot about, things that may happen over the, I think he called it a period of governance, but actually, if you are in arrears with your energy bills now, you want to know what the government are going to be doing come next September, October, when the budget comes out. You want to know how you're going to get through the winter. So being told that perhaps at some point over the period of governance, as Barry refers to it, something may or may not happen, I would say to people very clearly,
there's said to be an indication in this year's budget as to how that will play out over the next 5 years
with this government, because they did promise in the run into the course, we know in the run into the election, right, they told everyone they'd build 40,000 houses. That wasn't true. They also promised they would reduce college fees, and they're putting them up by €1,000. So, it's always the case with this government, check against.
I suppose it's slightly more accurate to say they're going back to where they were after a subsidy of €1,000 being provided.
If you paid €2,000 for your college fees for your child to go to college last year, and you're paying €3,000 this year, Colm, that's an increase of €1,000 in any man or woman's
language. When were the public informed of that reduction?
What they need to what they need to do is they need to ensure that they recognise that the cost of living crisis is not over for workers and families, right, and it must be addressed as part of the budget.
Barry Cowan, on the independent ministers in the government have been pushing for changes to the inheritance tax system for the beneficiaries of estates left by people who have no children. We were talking to Barry Rowntree about this earlier in the programme. Now, the argument has been made that it's unfair discrimination against people, particularly people who have no children. What's your own take on it?
There are provisions within the tax code for exemptions to that in relation to farm and business, and the opportunity to have full exemptions similar to that if there were direct descendants. But I think, you know, my perspective, I hear what's been said. I heard the argument for and against it. And I would think you can't have, you know, a 400 exemption for a descendant or for a son or daughter, and another 400 for a nephew or niece.
What about
a lifetime of 400 is fine, and if you want to take that initially.
But if there's not
an uncle or an aunt and lose the benefits that can be gained from your parents thereafter. So
the point is, if there's not a son or a daughter, so take the example of a house that's valued at about 300,000. There's a childless person wants to pass it on. The nephew, the niece would have an inheritance bill.
But it's taxed by the recipient that pays the tax. It's not the giver. It's not the aunt or the uncle. It's the recipient who's the beneficiary of the gain will be taxed accordingly. And there are exemptions in relation to people who live in that home that's made available to them or given to them by their aunt or uncle that they're exempt.
Right, but
they're exempt in relation to businesses.
There is a tax being paid on the family estate being left to a nephew or niece of a childless couple.
There's a tax being paid by the beneficiary, which is the case with all such inheritance.
All right. Louise O'Reilly, do you have any sympathy for the argument that's been made for people on inheritance tax? Do you think it should be reformed for people who are childless in order to allow them to leave on the same basis as a son or a daughter?
Well, I think the Barry Rowntree outlined fairly well, actually, something which is lost in this debate, which is the myriad of reliefs that are available already in this space. But I mean, if the government were serious about ensuring equity and fairness and putting money back into the pockets of workers and families, they'd be looking to cut the USC, which is where they should be applying their effort and energy and ensuring that people have that kind of.
All right, but on this specific one, you know, a childless couple or, you know, a single person living in an apartment wants to leave that apartment to a nephew or a niece. Should that nephew or niece incur a massive tax bill to inherit that property when that person dies, when a son or a daughter wouldn't?
Yeah, you're using the word massive there, and we don't know who this person is or how much the property
is. Well, I just gave an example, €300,000 and €85,000.
There are things that can be done within the tax code that will make the taxation system fairer and ensure that those who are best off pay the most. I don't believe that that is a way to do it.
Harry McGee, do you see this gathering momentum, given that there are members of the current coalition, namely the independent ministers, who want to see this reform?
It's 500,000 of a cost.
Yeah, I mean, the tax is, so the tax is 40%. And there are inequities there. If you have, I think there is a favourite nephew, favourite niece rule that applies that gives some exemptions. I think the exemption for a nephew and a niece is about 40,000 at the moment. And then the tax kind of kicks in, might even be lower than that. But then the tax kicks in after that. And there are some nephews and nieces who live in the house and are treated.
And there's another relief there, yeah, for that.
Qua son, qua daughter. So that relationship would have to be very close. But I think that the difficulty with this is that once you apply a new rule, the difficulty is where does the demarcation line lie? You know, where do people benefit and where do people get cut off? And it becomes difficult. You have some nephews and nieces that are more deserving than other nephews and nieces in relation to the relationship. So it would be a very difficult one to tailor. And I'm sure that there is inequity in the system as it is. And there are some, I mean, if somebody doesn't have any children and they do want to leave their estate to their nearest kin, you know, they must feel very hard done by if they can't do that without the nephew or niece incurring huge taxes. And the reality for them is that if they inherit the property, if the tax is at 40%, they will have to sell the property unless they're independently wealthy, which of course isn't the case in most cases. So I think there could be provision, but I think a kind of a general exemption, I think, would be far too wide and would capture too many people.
There's also the cost. It's 500 million. Generated in revenue resources and a wide, you know, as part of a wide tax base. And if people want to make those proposals, I think they should make counter proposals as to where the money would be got otherwise.
This was something that was actually Pascal Donoghue asked the tax strategy group to look at this in the course of preparing all those documents that are published in advance of the budget. And what they were saying at the time is that it's not out of the question or it's not unusual that different relatives would be taxed at different rates. That's actually quite a usual element of taxation systems. But what they were saying is that there is wiggle room, I guess, if they wanted to make that provision. I think it was this is not the exact wording in it, but it was something like designated heir or something like that, that you could pick one or two people that you could, if you didn't have children, that you could give the property to, that would come into that higher rate and that higher cutoff for tax. But it's a question.
I think the cost of that, their estimate on that in the tax strategy group was 390 million, slightly less than the 500 that
it's
was
still
being
a lot of money.
Barry
It is still a lot of money. So it's a question, and again, it all comes back to choice, really, doesn't it, in this budget? Do the government want to do it? Do they want to examine it further? I think we, you know, last year we did see changes to the inheritance tax system for the first time in a very long time. The rates were changed. The question is, do they want to do something again so soon? I think it's probably unlikely.
All right. Somebody in here texts and saying, myself and my same-sex partner have lived together for 30 years, own a large, valuable property together. We're not married. So when one of us dies, the other will end up having a large tax bill where they wouldn't if we were married. We feel like we're being forced to marry. That's one texter's from Dave. I have two sisters and a brother. Neither have children. All of substantial wealth they've worked incredibly hard to obtain over their lifetime. They're not farmers. They don't have businesses. They treat my children as their own and would like to leave their assets to them. It's unbelievable to think that a lifetime of work paying taxes, paying property tax, dirt tax, etc., and then the government takes a further 33%. And somebody else saying, I've paid taxes all my life, I'm single, no family. While I understand it's the beneficiary that pays tax, everything I have earned and paid all due tax on. Inheritance tax is a double, whichever way you look at it. Tax is already to date in the funds, irrespective of who the beneficiary is, says Claire. Somebody else saying, a single woman, no siblings, extended family, would love to see it extended to friends and children. So there's quite a lot of a response to that, Barry Cowan. They don't seem to be comforted by the notion that it's the beneficiary who pays.
I mean, like
they
I
don't
said,
want the beneficiary.
It could well be that you could have a lifetime exemption of 400,000 from parent or uncle or aunt, but once you pass that threshold, you pay your tax. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Donald Trump's tariffs officially kicked in yesterday. Irish businesses exporting to the US are trying to work out what the new 15% rate is going to mean to them. Louise Byrne, we thought we knew what was going to happen, and the certainty we were promised doesn't seem to be entirely evident.
Yeah, and I think that's the one thing that we have learned from the Trump administration, that just when you think you know what's going on, you have no clue all over again. And I think it was remarkable last Sunday week when this deal emerged, and, you know, it was saying it's giving clarity and it's giving, you know, all these, you know, promises to business. But realistically, we haven't got a clue. And I mean, if you look this week, President Trump has been talking about pharmaceuticals and how there's going to be additional taxes and how they're going to come in at 150% and all these mad numbers that he's saying, when it was taught that the agreement between the US and the EU was going to include that 50% on pharma. He's also looking at semiconductors, another industry that would be really, really impacted in Ireland if there were additional tariffs there. So it's one of those things, it just seems to have opened a can of worms. When you think you know what's going on, everything changes. And I think that is very concerning for not only exporters, but also employers and employees in these companies, these multinational companies that are based here. I know things like pharma and semiconductors are, you know, the production of them is difficult to move. But it is that uncertainty that we thought we had gotten over that has come back again. And God only knows what President Trump is going to announce he's doing next.
All right. Should the decision making of government be adjusted accordingly amid that uncertainty, Louise O'Reilly, touching slightly on what we were talking about earlier? Can we be guaranteed that things are going to be, it's going to be plain sailing?
Geez, I don't think there's any guarantees at all. I think this deal looks like a fairly bad deal because of the lack of certainty. The fact that, I mean, essentially by adopting the deal, Europe is accepting Donald Trump and the America's view of the world, which views them the richest country or one of the richest countries on the planet as being somehow the victim here, which is
bizarre. So do you think they should have retaliated?
I think that they should have been a bit tougher in terms of the deal, but also in terms of doing the, you know, like, it's one thing to sit in a room and come up with a number. It's quite another to actually get the clarity that businesses and workers need. And there does seem to be a certain amount of confusion. I'm not saying that's all on the European side. It's very much not. But there does seem to be confusion arising out of it. And I know that people thought that perhaps there would be certainty once the deadline passed. And it seems now that certainty isn't there, that there isn't the clarity that that businesses need. But I mean, you know, for the part of our government, they could concentrate when it comes to business. They could concentrate on those things which do ensure that business has a more stable environment here. They can look at things like improving our infrastructure, access to the grid, etc. Those are real threats to Indigenous business and indeed to FDI. Right. That's where the government's focus could be, on those things that they can control domestically.
And in the middle of all of this, Harry McGee, last night we saw in Congress a letter being sent by 16 Congress people to the Trade Secretary, highlighting Ireland's intention to pass the Occupied Territories Bill. We have record tax receipts. The highlight on the Occupied Territories Bill coming up at the same time, which will turn the focus to Ireland at a time where the last thing we want is focus on Ireland.
It will, and the letter has been sent to Scott Bessent, and I mean, it's a development, but I think it's a development that the government should ignore. You know, I mean, you either stand up to the courage of your convictions in relation to the legislation you pass, and you stand on your own two feet as an independent republic, because if you start to sway with the wind in relation to principles, and we're talking about a principle here, and it's not just a principle, it's not just the kind of the politics, it's a piece of legislation, you know. And okay, there's still a debate about trade and services, but the Occupied Territory Bill as it is, I think that if the government were to abandon it, I think the government would have no integrity at all. So I do think that this is just a move, another one of dozens and hundreds of moves, political plays that you're going to see in the States in a very volatile, very turbulent, very uncertain political environment. And you see very unreasonable propositions being made. And I just think that it's very, very important for the Irish government to stay the course.
Right.
And to look at these things rationally, and to ensure that we are doing our politics in a way that is honest, and that's integrity, and that stands according to our principles. And I just, you know, I mean, there's so many European countries that stood idly by with what's happening in Gaza. You see Germany, for example, still providing arms to the Israeli Defence Forces as it now begins an assault on Gaza City. And I just think that we at some stage we have to stand up and say these are our principles and we have to be consistent with our principles.
Barry Cowan, the title of the government's version of the Occupied Territories Bill is specifically directed as illegal Israeli settlements on the occupied Palestinian territories. It may come to pass that services will be included in that, but the original draft of the bill by Francis Black never mentioned Israel. It never mentioned any occupying power and could have been used more broadly, which might have equipped the government with the argument by adopting that this wasn't targeting Israel at all. It was only targeting occupying powers on a case-by-case basis, and the one here happened to be Israel.
Exactly. And, you know, the what you hear from Netanyahu and his government in recent days makes that all the more evident for such a bill to be in place to address that. And I do note, you know, some movement by the international community in recent weeks that we welcome. But I am with Harry on this in the sense that, you know, it's terrible, disappointing to say the least, to note many European countries are not on the same page as the rest of us on this. And having spoken to von der Leyen herself in a private audience with my colleagues from Fianna Fáil in recent weeks, you know, she spoke about even needing unanimity before she could act accordingly. And, you know, we can only play our part in diplomatic means by which we seek support for our stance, support for the bill that we propose. But I could come back to the point that was made in relation to tariffs by Louise. She seemed to be rubbishing the deal that was agreed, as difficult as it was to achieve. There's nobody inside government or outside saying a 15% tariff on exports to the US by companies here is a cause for celebration. It's a framework agreement initially, detailing, you know, sets a baseline rate of 15% with some negotiations ongoing into some areas, for example, in relation to aviation.
Okay,
to drinks. But you can't, the point I want to make is you can't politically say you oppose compromise, and at the same time oppose confrontation when you knew
Louise,
the confrontation
Louise O'Reilly,
would
I
put us off a cliff.
I want to go back to the occupied territories
bill,
because
there's
obviously been a lobbying effort on Capitol Hill that triggered these 16 Congress people to write this letter to the Trade Secretary. I mean, you decided, you know, not to go to Washington on St. Patrick's Day, and, you know, would efforts be better spent working all the levers possible and cementing better relations on Capitol Hill to try and generate the kind of support in opposition to the kind of moves that have been made, rather than, I suppose, snubbing the White House on St. Patrick's Day?
Okay, so there is an ongoing genocide against the people of Gaza and Palestine unfolding at the moment. And the reason that it is happening is because the perpetrators of that genocide, the Israeli regime, feel no consequences. They must feel a consequence for their actions. So therefore, it behoves every single person in any position of power. And nobody suggests, and I have said this in the Dáil, nobody suggests that the government does nothing. But what people do say is that the government can and they should do more. And in the face of a genocide, which will not stop until Israel feels consequences, I think we should be leaders in the international community, as we were previously in relation to apartheid in South Africa. We need to be leaders in the international community. And absolutely, there are people in America, there are people in high political office in America who do not support the genocide. Those are the people who we must reach out to. Those are the people that we must have the relationship with, and those are the people that we must work with. But mark my words, Colm, this will continue until Israel feels a consequence for their genocide.
OK, we'll take a break. We're back in a minute.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.